Don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on July 10th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to discuss media consolidation in local TV and newspapers, and to discuss protections for on-call part-time retail workers. All that and more is coming up. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again this week in studio is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And joining us on the line from Idaho again this week is Rachel. Hi, Rachel. Welcome back.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on again.
So we're going to be talking this week about media consolidation, especially local media, you know, TV news stations, newspapers, that sort of thing. This is a huge topic. I have personally heard academic lectures for, you know, an hour or so or more on this, but we're primarily interested in some fairly narrow specific aspects that have been brought up again by some recent developments in the news. In particular, I think a lot of people are talking about the Sinclair acquisition. I know like there was a John Oliver segment about that, I guess we can mention in passing. But this has been something that's been on our docket for, you know, a month or two now since it was announced that they were trying to pursue this acquisition deal. Nate, why don't you walk us through what is being proposed in this deal?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's been some discussions of Sinclair over the past couple of years. I feel like just they've slowly been building this sort of media empire, various, you know, local news stations. Also, you have some radio stations, I believe. And what ties us in with the Trump administration, I think, is important to note that Kushner, apparently Jared, made a deal during the campaign with the head of Sinclair, where they would provide access to Trump. They gave Trump a lot of interviews, or he did a lot of interviews from them. And then he, in exchange, they would basically get fair coverage, which means, you know, sort of fawning and very positive coverage. And so, yeah, over the campaign, they did 15 interviews with Trump, including 11 during the final 3 months. And these were often in critical states like Pennsylvania, Ohio. They did a bunch with Mike Pence and none with Hillary Clinton, although a couple with Tim Kaine. And so they also have various packages that get put in sort of local news. So they have like conservative commentaries ranting about campus snowflakes or something like that, you know, the typical conservative talking points there. And they get also these sort of must run stories where the head of Sinclair or the central group there will email out must run stories to various stations all across the country. And you know, these end up being quite questionable, oftentimes news stories with a very right leaning slant. And so they're looking to buy up the Tribune Media Corp, which also has a bunch of stations around the country. And if the acquisition goes through, and it's looking like that's quite likely, they're going to possibly have access to up to 70% of all U.S. households. That's some pretty unprecedented media reach, and media consolidation has been obviously slimming down to basically about six companies that control all of the media now. So you know, this is a further step towards that. So I think this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and, you know, this radio show is broadcast at WVUD, which is affiliated to the University of Delaware. So it's always great when we get to talk about a University of Delaware angle here. And there is this is something that University of Delaware's, you know, various Center for Community Research and Service, the Center for Political Communication, that sort of thing. They have invested a lot in that. That's, you know, some of the programs that I went through. But they have invested in providing money to do research on this media consolidation phenomenon. There is a great paper that you can find online by Danilo Janich on politics, policy, content, and media consolidation. This was presented at the APPAM conference in November 2016. So some of it's obviously predating this latest Sinclair deal, but shows these trends that Nate was talking about toward this consolidation. In fact, there's some quotes in the paper about like owners speculating that everything is consolidating to eventually that there's going to be like four sort of super group corporations that own, you know, every single local station, TV news station in the country. And then, you know, that also, that's only telling you about the actual direct ownership. And then one of the things that I know that the University of Delaware has researched, and some of this is included in the paper as well, is some of these other forms of consolidation that are a lot more under the radar. And there had been kind of moderate steps toward regulating them in the late stages of the Obama administration, but really kind of a lot of too little too late on that front. This is in particular, the duopoly and service agreements set up is something that is of particular interest and only dates back as far as 2000. So the very end of the Clinton administration. You know, Nate can go over some of the statistics here, but this research is really important and it's not necessarily getting put out there, which is one reason I thought it would be good to talk about it. It's also partially funded by the Communication Workers of America, which is a major union that works with a lot of these companies. So that's, I think, a very important demonstration of things that a union can do when they have a large membership and funding still. You might have seen CWA was involved with the Verizon strikes and the AT&T strikes recently. They were also an early endorsing union for Bernie Sanders, or one of the few, I should say, that endorsed him at all. There's a number of different types of service agreements that, like I said, that are different than just ownership consolidation of the actual corporations. Just very briefly kind of explaining. So there's local news sharing agreements. Those are literally a bunch of stations owned by different companies will pool together their journalists, editors, equipment, and content. And what happens there is that, instead of having everyone send their trucks, you know, with their satellite dishes and everything and their cameras to the scene of a local murder or what have you, that they send one crew that then produces a package. And then they say, you know, for, you know, WABC, this is whatever. And then also for WXYZ, and they only show one version of, but it's the same footage and the same story cut together for two different stations. And they're owned by two different companies. Now, their rationale was always, oh, this is a vital cost saving measure, blah, blah, blah. That basically, you know, on the one hand, they are correct in that there's not much difference between sending two different teams in trucks to the same exact news story as there is in sending one that, you know, but that's more of a problem of local TV news needed to be more diverse anyway. That's not really a great justification. Also, there's some various statistics in here where, like, there are certain markets where literally 100% of the stories from two different stations are identical. They're owned by different companies, but they have identical stories on everything because they have completely consolidated their news coverage like that. There's also joint sales agreement. That's more complicated stuff like how they deal with advertising time and dealing with competitors, offering competitors sort of various deals and revenue sharing agreements. There's shared service agreements where, that's a form of combining newsrooms and various personnels, that sort of thing. And that is completely separate from actual mergers of these companies. That's like a whole different problem that is also being discussed here. Nate, did you want to throw a few statistics here and there on some of these things?
Okay, so under the services agreement, the stations would combine newsrooms, assets, as you mentioned, Bill. And so June 2015, so this is last year, only 28% of local television stations in the U.S. Are reported to be in a service agreement. In the top 100 television markets, where you have 86% of all TV households, 18 companies control over three quarters of the station. So you're seeing, especially in these high traffic areas, you have even more media consolidation. As a part of this, there was a recent court ruling against a bunch of interest groups that were opposed to the Sinclair deal and media consolidation in general. So I'm reading here from a release from the National Hispanic Media Coalition, and they grouped with groups such as Common Cause, Media Alliance, and also the United Church of Christ. And they were petitioning the FCC, and the court ruling that came down basically, I guess, is a reversal of an Obama administration era decision. And this would basically let large TV groups such as Sinclair evade a cap on how many stations they own by basically only counting half the audience. So they can stay within a congressionally established limit of only 39%. So basically, it seems like they can go up to 80% if they're only counting half. So I feel like that's important to throw in there just because this could basically lead to the 70% we talked about.
Right. So that's sort of the central point here is that there's two, it's like a pincer of two different kinds of media consolidation in local TV news. One is the actual corporate ownership consolidating down to fewer and fewer companies. And then there's also these service agreements that get around the, like, I mean, that's what they created this for. This mechanism is to evade all of the antitrust things like what Nate was talking about, you know, coming up with workarounds against the official regulations that try to prevent consolidation of these companies. They are evading it by coming up with these joint agreements, which is basically, I mean, that's a cartel practice where you're not officially merging the companies. You're just having these competing companies coming up with agreements with each other to sort of rig things. The other thing before we go to Rachel that this paper stresses is that a lot of these deals, especially the actual mergers, require a lot of debt on the part of the companies to come up with the, you know, the cash to purchase these other companies. And the problem is that once you've mounted all this debt, then you're going to need to cut costs. So it becomes this vicious cycle where, you know, every time they consolidate, supposedly that's going to save money, but in fact it requires them to cut a lot of things in order to save money because they've taken on all this debt. Rachel, what was the angle that you wanted to cover on this story?
I've been doing quite a bit of reading about print media consolidation in regards to daily newspapers. So over the years, there's been a lot of buyouts by these big chains of newspaper owners, such as like McClatchy Group, News Corp, and Lee. So in Boise, we have a local newspaper called the Idaho Statesman. It used to be owned by Knight Ritter, and I believe in 2009, it got bought out by, no, in 2006, it got bought out by McClatchy Corp. So when a paper is owned by these huge chains, they don't really get to control like the local news that gets published. And so a lot of those local interest stories get kind of fall by the wayside, and you pretty much get the same news stories that you can read in any newspaper across the country. So it seems like the kind of raison d'etre of the local news is to get stories that interest the community. And so, and with the rise of news websites, you're just getting a lot of generic, just uninteresting, bland news stories. And newspapers are relying a lot more on ad revenues, which as readership goes down, ad revenues go down. So it's just kind of this vicious cycle that has led to a lot of monopolization of newspaper ownership. And I have a statistic at since 2004, over one third of all American newspapers have been bought out. So it's a really dire situation. And also the three largest companies own about 900 newspapers that have a combined circulation of 12.7 million. So there's a lot of control happening as to the news stories that make it to the pages of the newspaper. And it's just, it's very sad for local communities. They're not getting the news that interests them. You don't get that like local investigative journalism. So expose is about like maybe lead in school drinking fountains or like ceiling tiles falling down on children. And you're kind of missing out on like digging deep into local interest stories.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point. And it's especially interesting to hear the perspective of coming out of Boise. You know, in Boston, the Globe was bought out once, and then forget exactly what happened with the Herald, but obviously multiple newspapers. But this really hits home, especially in smaller cities where you maybe only have one newspaper and start losing out on some of this local reporting that actually, as you mentioned, conditions such as lead contamination or general focusing on, say, like local corruption or things like that, or just the bills that are coming out of the state houses, a lot of these don't get covered nearly as much as maybe they even would like last decade. And I think another thing is interesting to point out is that, as you mentioned, with the ad revenue, increasingly, you know, that's going online and it's not even going to the companies on their online. In many cases, it's going to like Google or Facebook or, you know, Amazon or something else like that, because people are just clicking on these articles through these platforms. So I guess there's a collective bargaining that several newspapers are trying to do with Google and Amazon. I've heard that recently. There was an article posted today in Fusion about that. And so, you know, you're sort of wondering, where does all this go? Are we just going to end up with a couple portals or something that have very little to no local coverage, but are all, you know, there's the Facebook news and there's the Google news or whatever. And then we no longer have any of this sort of on the ground reporting or reporting that actually impacts local communities in the way that we used to have. So that's a potentially dire situation.
And I think almost anywhere you go in the country, people have stories about, you know, the recent declines in the coverage quality and breadth and diversity and that sort of thing in any of their newspapers, just like with the TV stuff like we were talking about earlier. You know, around here, we theoretically have more newspapers than maybe there are in Boise, but even then, there's a relatively small number of owners, and they sometimes you have the newspapers, especially the local community ones, sharing a very small number of staff. Or there was something recently where I think they decided to get rid of all the editors or something like that and just make them all basically bloggers. Like,
yeah, I mean, they're, you know, basically glorified blogs at this point.
Right. And even something like the Globe, I mean, if Jonathan Cohn were here, he would be talking at great length, I'm sure, about how the coverage is so conservative, even in the Boston Globe, which isn't even supposed to be the quote unquote conservative paper. Like, for a long time, the Herald was the conservative paper in Boston, or more conservative. And that's just not even like the Boston Globe is representing in not their editorials, even just their actual news coverage, right, if it's local at all, as opposed to being like an AP Wire story or a New York Times story. It tends to slant into a very, like, you know, conservative leaning perspective that definitely helps like Governor Baker and that kind of thing.
Well, there was an article too on white supremacists in the Globe or something a couple months ago that had like a strange, very strange headline.
I forget what the thing was, but a lot of people were very outraged about that.
Yeah, it's with Trump in power, comma, white power groups try to build alliances. And I guess this is actually a AP article, but this was a headline in the Globe and I didn't see it anywhere else. So.
Right. That was the front page headline there, I think, that bothered people. You know, and that's like, again, this is happening in Massachusetts, so you can imagine like that it's much worse in a lot of these other states where there's even less pushback that they're getting for being like wildly conservative and misrepresented. And whether it's newspapers or whether it's TV or radio or whatever, I mean, that's the thing that's so disturbing about all this, is those numbers that we were talking about at the beginning and that Rachel was talking about with regard to the newspapers, of just the sheer like volume of how many people get their news from these sources, and they now don't even really know if they're missing something. And, you know, Nate was talking about like when Sinclair you know, hands down this order from the top of the corporate ladder that says you have to run this on every station in the country, that's very obviously taking away minutes that could be on some local story that's just to go along with whatever this guy is. And I don't know, for some reason, like, it seems like, you know, this has been an issue for a while, obviously, but that it was being spun as the kind of this like conspiracy theory that liberals were, you know, like worried about corporate consolidation of media. And it's like, it's not a conspiracy because they make these deals with like the Trump campaign and stuff
right.
like that.
Well, going back to the 04 campaign, I believe they ran some Swiftboat Veterans for Truth stuff about Kerry on a lot of these Sinclair networks, including like a documentary, and they had a lot of other coverage going back to that abysmal race.
Right. And like, obviously it's a conservative company that was going to slant conservative anyway, but then it's like, there's no reason that you can't regulate to stop these kind of mergers if you want to, but you have to make the decision as a society that you're going to regulate these kind of things, that you're going to make it so that you can't do these service agreements to get around merger prevention laws, that you can't, you know, that you can't have these giant mega acquisitions. I mean, what was that statistic again on Sinclair? How many people they were going to have in the like potential household reach?
70% of the population.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's obviously not everyone is watching a Sinclair owned station, but again, like, you know, the consolidation is such that many people in many areas, especially rural areas, may only have one station really for news.
Right. Well, there's a Pew Research study from last year that says nearly 60% of American adults get their news from television, and 50% of those rely on local stations.
Right.
So, you know, especially in smaller towns or, as you said, rural areas, people are going to be looking from stuff online. They're going to be looking at their local news because they may not even have a local newspaper at this point. So
I mean, there's so much drama too, you know, in these discussions that we have about like Fox or MSNBC or CNN or whatever, and it's like, well, none of that matters compared to the scale of what's happening in local news on TV. Rachel, your closing thoughts on this topic?
I would just like to point out that there is a good website called newspaperownership.com that does have an interactive map of the U.S. So you can see exactly who owns these papers, how many papers are in a county of interest, a state of interest. So I think it can really help to illuminate the problems for maybe your local area, so you can see just how bad it is in your area.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD to talk about issues of contracts and scheduling for various part-time workers, which is another important topic. So stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill, and in studio with me is Nate, and on the line from Idaho is Rachel. So, Rachel, we are talking in this segment about the issue of on-call scheduling, worker rights in the retail and fast food fields, those kind of sectors, and what the Labour Party in Britain has called zero-hour contracts, which I honestly think is a better name than on-call scheduling, because on-call scheduling makes you think of a doctor or something like that. But zero-hour contracts is what they call it in the United Kingdom, and that basically means that you are guaranteed a part-time job, but you don't have any guarantee of how many hours or any sort of minimum hours or anything like that that you would be getting for a given week. And we're going to talk about what some places are doing to try to curb that and what some of the problems that are associated with that are. So Rachel, our news hook this week for this segment is Oregon. Take us there.
So Oregon has approved legislation mandating predictable work schedules for low-wage employees. So, and Governor Kate Brown does plan to sign the measure, and the law will take effect in July 2018. And what it does is it guarantees workers greater freedom to plan their life-work balance. Workers have to be informed of their schedules 1 week beforehand. This affects industries with 500 employees or more. So oftentimes those huge food service employers, retail employers, hospitality employers, this really affects them the most. And in 2020, the notice period increases to 2 weeks beforehand. It also mandates that workers get 10 hours of rest between shifts. So it kind of gets rid of that clopening. You close a shift and then you come right back to work and have an opening shift. Or, and if these industries do violate this, they have to pay their workers an overtime rate of 1.5 hours for their work. And Oregon is the first state to pass this type of legislation, but cities such as New York, San Francisco, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. have enacted similar measures. But it's really encouraging to see this happen on a greater scale, because we can't rely on companies to just kind of benevolently provide these schedules in advance or guarantee a certain number of hours in a week or such things like that, because we can't. It's not a guarantee that these industries will be kind to their low wage employees.
Right. And it's obviously a huge problem for people, you know, working families, mothers especially, have been hard hit by a lot of this stuff. You know, if they're working at Walmart or wherever, if you're being asked to basically, like, you could have hours today, you could have hours anytime this week, we're not going to tell you when those are, you might not find out until, you know, a couple hours before your shift or something like that, you might even be commuting in on the way to work, and then you've lost your, you know, you're going to have to turn around and you've lost a bunch of time and you can't plan any sort of family activities, you can't plan going to take someone to the doctor, that kind of thing. And then, of course, what's really bad is that, and this has created a huge problem in the labor market, you can't get a second job if you don't have fixed hours for your first job. So, like, ideally, my position is that everyone should be able to support themselves on one full-time job if that's what they want. But we have seen that many people are, you know, getting part-time or even full-time jobs and then having to get a second job or even a third job, depending on, you know, how many hours they're doing in order to make ends meet. That's bad, but it's even worse when you can't do that because you are unable to predict your shift hours enough to be able to go get a different job. And, you know, this is something that has been mounting for a while. Obviously, like I said, there is a push in parallel in the United Kingdom to work on this. There's a number of the state attorneys general last spring in April 2016, led especially by Schneiderman from New York, who's a very progressive attorney general on a lot of these sort of labor rights issues and things like that. You know, so him with along with seven other states and the D.C. Counterpart, they sent a letter to a lot of the retail companies to inquire about or issue some warnings about the use of these on-call shifts and that sort of thing. Basically trying to primarily find information on like how widespread this is, that sort of thing. But the letter did say, quote, on-call shifts are unfair to workers who must keep their day free, arrange for childcare, and give up the chance to get another job or attend a class. On-call shifts are not a business necessity, as we see many retailers that no longer use this unjust method of scheduling work hours. And then this went to a lot of retailers that people have heard of: American Eagle, Aeropostale, Payless, Disney, Coach, PacSun, Forever 21, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole long list here. And so it's great to see some Democratic attorneys general working on this issue together, although there aren't that many Democratic attorneys general left. So that's probably why that was a pretty short list. But jumping off of the point that he brought up about whether or not this is a business necessity, we do not normally go to provide the business perspective on this, and we're obviously not going to be providing their favorable perspective on this. But Nate, why don't you walk us through a little bit about some of the debate on the role of this within the business community? Is this even something that is quote unquote necessary or like a bad idea even for the businesses themselves, not just the workers?
Right. Well, apparently the National Retail Federation believes that retailers should have the power to make scheduling decisions on their own. So that's kind of predictable. Large business organizations generally tend not to be all that happy with this sort of thing coming in from the...
They're not the vanguard of the proletariat.
Well, not exactly. But what is interesting is there is a this guy, John Orr, I'm reading from a CNBC article, a senior vice president of retail at Ceridian Workforce Management, said that retailers who use on-call strategy often end up with an unhappy workforce, which leads to a higher turnover rate because of all the reasons, as we mentioned. You know, it's going to be much more difficult to arrange for transportation, childcare, going to like the doctors or something like that if you don't know what days you're going to work until a couple hours before. And then this higher turnover rate then leads these businesses which oftentimes are sort of like your mall chains or things like that. But that they have to spend more time searching for new employees and getting them trained. And then in many cases, this also leads to poor customer service because you have these unhappy employees that don't really have a high satisfaction with their job. And so they sort of are not super friendly to the customers, as you might understand. And here's a quote from this guy: or they think they're saving money, but it's poor planning. If you're planning better, you don't need that extra fudge factor. And this sort of comes up, I guess, up in the debate, maybe in the with regards to the minimum wage as well. It's like, if you can't actually pay your workers a decent wage, what are you doing? Like, why even have a business if you can't provide normal scheduling so they can plan their lives around their work? Why are you even hiring them, or what's the point here? So
it seems like you're not very good at business. You might be, as I always put it, you might be great at capitalism, but you're not necessarily good at running a business.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a difference there. Also, just want to add, there's a report from the Economic Policy Institute that says about 10% of the workforce is assigned to either regular or on-call hours. And these employees basically can have, as we mentioned, work-family conflicts, can hinder children's education, et cetera. And the co-author says, I don't think that companies on their own are going to choose to care for their employees over making a quick profit. There needs to be legislation in place. So a couple companies have voluntarily suspended the practice, but obviously all aren't.
And that raises a good point, right? Rachel was talking about how Oregon was the first state to take action. Obviously, there are also cities that have taken action. There are certain components of the Oregon law that have been done elsewhere. New York State apparently already has a regulation. I don't think it's a law, but it's a regulation that says an employee who by request or permission of the employer reports for work on a day, on any day, shall be paid for at least 4 hours or the number of hours in the regularly scheduled shift, whichever is less, at the basic minimum hourly wage. So if you were scheduled for like 5-6 hours that day or something, and you get there and they're like, no, we actually don't need you, then you have to get paid for at least 4 hours of that as partial compensation, but you're only being paid at minimum wage. You might be making more than that if you were actually doing the hours. So that's not like great, but at least it's something. And that sort of shows you that there is some momentum in certain areas to like actually try to work on this. But it needs to go, obviously, a lot more comprehensively. Jobs with Justice, and in particular the San Francisco chapter of Jobs with Justice, has been promoting this agenda. They talk about just hours and stable schedules. San Francisco talks about retail workers' rights. These would include things like a full-time hours offer, predictable scheduling, and minimum on-call pay. So we've already talked about minimum on-call pay. We've already talked about predictable scheduling. The third component there is a full-time hours offer, which is basically like you should have to offer your existing part-time employees the option to go to full-time if you need more workers to pick up more hours before you go out hiring even more of these, you know, on-call part-time workers, right? That if you have a labor situation that you need to solve it first by offering full-time positions to people in case they want them before you go around hiring even more of those people. That is something that I would definitely like to see more of, and that I don't think is in the Oregon law. But that is sort of would it speaks to that issue of just hours and stable scheduling as well, but it also speaks to a broader macroeconomic issue regarding underemployment, which is something that we've talked a lot about. Because you don't just need the stable hours to be able to go get another job, because as I said earlier, I think you should be trying to have it so that people can earn a living at one job full time if that's what they want. Obviously, some people prefer to have a more flexible scheduling and part-time scheduling because it does afford you various other opportunities. I am obviously someone who works a pretty flexible part-time schedule, although, you know, it'd be nice to make more money, I think. But there is a big problem in the economy of people who would desperately like to get more hours of working, work full time and that sort of thing. And they are just unable to. And all these things, you know, couple them all together. They shouldn't be separated from each other. Same with minimum wage increases. These things all go together. We don't want to sound like we're, you know, Jeb Bush saying with that famous gaffe, Americans want to work longer hours, which by that what he was trying to say was that there are many Americans who would prefer to work full time rather than getting these bad part-time jobs with total, you know, unreliability and flexibility. Rachel, what are your thoughts on all of this beyond the sort of the Oregon law?
I would have loved to have this available when I was working part-time, when I was starting out in my job searches as a teen and in my early 20s, especially the part where there's you get a set amount of hours expected at the, like, when you're on hire, and then if the company doesn't schedule you for that number of hours, they get penalized. I would have loved that. I did get retaliated against. If a manager didn't like me, they cut my hours, and to be protected would have made me feel a lot better. And also the opportunity to get more hours. I think I worked about 20, 25 hours a week. And if I could have worked more hours, I would have gladly taken that. I can definitely see how some people who want to have a flexible work week would be happy with 20 or 25 hours. But at that time of life, I definitely could have used extra money at that time.
Well, so. Actually, to go to a specific point that you mentioned, I think that we neglected to talk about this earlier in the segment, but beyond issues of, you know, family life, childcare, elder care concerns, things like that, you mentioned in passing retaliation, and mm-hmm. that's got a huge gender component, obviously also a racial component, but especially mm-hmm. many women, I think, right, would feel that this is a protection, a gender equity protection from dealing with, like, sexual harassment in the workplace and stuff like that, right?
Right, definitely. I've read many stories, many anecdotes. I know the plural of anecdote is not data, but I've read it time and time again. If higher-ups felt that their workers weren't respecting them enough, they would cut hours. Or if a worker brought up a safety issue or, like you said, a sexual harassment issue, they definitely got retaliated against, and their hours got cut to the point where they just had to find a new job because they just weren't getting any hours at their current job.
And that slow fade issue seems to be a big problem too. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you talk a little bit about that, but just the, I mean, it's kind of like being ghosted on except by your employer.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're trying to make a budget and you predict that you're going to work a certain amount of hours in a week or in a month, and that goes away, you're often left in the lurch and you just don't know how you're going to make it for the rest of the week or the month.
And just again, to provide sort of a comparative politics angle here, you know, I've mentioned several times throughout this that the Labour Party in the United Kingdom under Jeremy Corbyn ran on, you know, even before their 2017 manifesto, but especially in that, ran on dealing with that. They said legislating against 0-hour contracts. There are many more workers on short hours contracts, some only guaranteed a few hours per week, but who regularly work far more. We will strengthen the law so that those who work regular hours for more than 12 weeks will have a right to a regular contract reflecting those hours. That would be something that I don't think has come up in any of this discussion, but I assume that's understandable for people, but I'll just recap it briefly here in case you weren't following quite what was being said there. But basically that you were being told that you had, we'll guarantee you at least this many hours per day or per week. And I think that's going to be the next stage after these minimum protections are in place in some of these states and cities. But also that if they say to you, like, oh, we'll probably give you 20 hours a week or something like that, or 15 hours a week, but then for 12 weeks or more consecutively, they are giving you, 30 hours or even 40 hours a week of work, then they should not be having you on a part-time contract with that flexibility. That means that they obviously need to have full-time workers, so they should just give you a full-time worker contract if that's what you want. They're going to keep trying to come up with workarounds, but that's something to bear in mind as well. This 0-hour contract, as they call it in the UK, and then also dealing with these abusive part-time contracts, that's something that we need to be like, I want the Democrats to be running on this here, not just in Oregon, not just in New York City or New York State. Like, they need to actually be pushing things to deal with this. And it's disturbing that they haven't, frankly, because, like, the SEIU is one of the big unions that still exists and hasn't completely collapsed. that is still out there, you know, pounding the pavement for Democrats, and they represent all these like retail workers and care workers and fast food workers and things like that. And then there's obviously all these non-unionized workers at various other retail establishments. Like the Democrats refusing to push this issue at a systemic level is bananas. Nate?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty consistent, though, with what we've seen from the Democratic Party on a number of these economic issues, you know, especially over the past several decades as they've thoroughly embraced neoliberalism. But I think this issue does need to be a key one going into the next primary. And also, we've got probably primaries coming up for various House races as well. So I think people out there need to be pressuring their candidates, their representatives, to make this an issue, and so that when the 2018 primaries for president come around, we can actually pressure for a platform that is actually talked about, not just one that's quote-unquote the most progressive platform in history that doesn't get talked about and probably wouldn't have been implemented, but that's another story. So I think this needs to be an issue that people need to be pushing the representatives on, and if we can make this sort of a baseline thing like we see in Britain now, that could potentially attract more people as more and more people are affected by these kind of haphazard scheduling, and people more and more feel like they don't have a consistent information about their employment status or anything like that. So this could potentially be a pretty significant issue, but only if the Democrats actually embrace it, which is questionable at best.
Yeah, and retail is going to continue to be a huge, huge front in labor organizing and labor politics in the United States. Whether the Democrats like it or not, that's where it's going to be, and we're going to need to deal with it. You know, there's been plenty of research on other aspects of retail labor abuses, like the fact that, you know, Walmart employees and McDonald's employees and that sort of thing are frequently on food stamps. And at that point, your labor operational costs are not only undercutting every other company, you know, small business or whatever in your area, and making them uncompetitive, but clearly you're not competitive either at that price because you're paying so little that your workers are having to draw from, you know, the public coffers, which is fine. Like, that's okay if they have to do that, but they shouldn't have to do that, right?
Well, like, it's a strategy.
Right.
And they help the workers, like, apply for food stamps as well. Like, they know that this is what they're doing.
Yeah. And so they are outsourcing part of their labor costs to the U.S. federal government and the taxpayers while simultaneously being mega tax evaders. You know, companies like Walmart and McDonald's are notable for their avoidance, we'll say, of taxes through various legal mechanisms and loopholes. The notion that we're just going to somehow be able to skate by and not pay any attention to all these retail workers and their very clear labor practice abuses and wage abuses, that's just not realistic. And that's the other thing that I want to stress in closing here too. Like, a lot of these folks, some of them are younger workers, you know, some of them are like Rachel starting out, you know, in teenage and early 20s years, but a lot of these folks are, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, even, you know, people know the Walmart and Home Depot greeters that are, you know, trying to make ends meet in old age. This is a broad spectrum issue that affects a lot of different people from a lot of different cross sections. This is the working class. When we're talking about the working class, in an economy that is surging toward this service-oriented, retail-oriented, you know, fast-food-oriented, all that kind of stuff, economy, this is the working class. Obviously, there are also working-class members who work at a factory somewhere or work in the mine somewhere, and we care about and talk about them as well. But if your analysis of the working class, your discussions of the working class, your political appeals to the working class are based on a very narrow sliver and not this broad spectrum of people of various ages. There's all these gender equity issues that we've talked about. There's a huge racial justice dimension to this. That's what Jobs with Justice in particular deals with a lot of, as does SEIU, with the fact that we're talking in many cases about Hispanic workers, African-American workers, that sort of thing. This is the working class we're talking about. This is the only working class we can be talking about, is one that encompasses every angle and not just some of them. This is the working class that we need to be appealing to, building up, helping to protect, building up a mass party politics on behalf of and for and by and with. This notion that when we're talking about the working class that we just mean some white guys from the Rust Belt is preposterous. We're talking about people all over this country in every single state, red states, blue states, purple states. It doesn't matter. The service economy and the retail economy is such that it exists virtually everywhere. There are Walmarts everywhere. There are McDonald's everywhere. You know, it doesn't, it's not just Oregon. It's not just New York. It's not just the Rust Belt. We're talking about places like Texas. We're talking as much as California. We're talking about, you know, Minnesota and Alabama and, you know, Georgia and Missouri and all these different states. This is the working class in the early 21st century in the United States. If we're not talking about that in a responsible and an all-encompassing manner, and we're not building a politics that appeals to and serves the needs of these communities, then we're not obviously doing what we should be doing, and we're not doing it right. Rachel, your closing thoughts on this topic?
I just wanted to point out that Idaho has one of the highest rates of minimum wage workers in the country. I believe we have the 9th highest rate of workers earning minimum wage. So if the Democrats in Idaho especially really want to overturn this one-party rule that we've had for about 3 or 4 decades, I think if they did themselves with labor causes, it would definitely have a huge impact on the makeup of our state legislature or our governor's mansion or even city councils for that matter. So I think the Idaho Democrats really need to take this time of soul searching and really think about the way they want to protect workers and protect the citizens of Idaho.
Rachel, thanks for being here to talk about both of these stories.
Thanks for having me again, Bill.
And Nate, your closing thoughts?
Well, just as I mentioned a little bit earlier, I think this is an issue that needs to be front and center, especially within the Democratic Party. But I think also in the media as well, people need to be pushing out and sort of getting this issue more attention, because I feel like it hasn't really gotten a ton of attention in the U.S. media, maybe a little bit more in the British media after the Labor Manifesto. But this, I think, needs to be something that we push for coming 2018 and 2020.
Thank you for being here in studio.
Great to be here, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.